welcome to another special episode of the Kung Fu Conversations. This is one of your co-hosts, Randall Davis, over here, and I'm continuing the Warriorship Conversing conversation today with the talented, world-renowned, pretty effing awesome Coach Kevin Secours. Coach Kevin, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coach, if you would be so kind, I know you've said it a few other places.
Yeah.
But would you give everyone a little bit of your background today?
Yeah. I started martial arts when I was 10. Like many people, I had a violent encounter. I got jumped by some older boys, was really angry, really small. And I started training in the first thing that basically cropped up, which was local Shotokan karate at the mall. It was not a good fit for me, but I didn't know, and I was, I just really thought the martial arts were one thing. And so I had the pajamas and here I go, so I was doing it like three times a week. And I lasted about 6 years in Shotokan, until I encountered jiu-jitsu. And then when I met my sensei in jiu-jitsu, it was definitely a question of the style being a better fit, but definitely it was the instructor was a better fit. And that just really, he just salvaged me from my stupidity, and made me expect a lot more. And then I was with him pretty much full time for a few years. And then after about 3 years, he moved, and that left this huge void. And I think it was the combination of having such a great teacher and then not having him that, that really led to the search. And so then I was doing everything. I did Aikido for a while. I did the judo. I was, in college, I was doing judo. The closest thing, we had some Daito-ryu jiu-jitsu where I was, but it was really classical. And my sensei had been Japanese military, and he was a military cop, and he had a lot of pragmatic experience, and he was very eclectic. I wouldn't even say Western. He was quite holistic. So I was trying to find somebody like him. And I would find, maybe an ex-military guy or a bouncer that had pragmatic experience, but they didn't necessarily have the martial pedigree. Then I would find somebody with the depth of martial knowledge, but they didn't really have pragmatic experience. I ended up doing a lot of Kenpo. I was doing Shaolin Kenpo. I did some five animal Kenpo. I did, what did I do after that? I went into Kenpo Jiu-Jitsu finally, which was sort of a larger amount of Jiu-Jitsu than the other Kenpos. But I was always really looking for that mainline pure Japanese jiu-jitsu, and I wasn't really finding it. Over the years, I dabbled in Sambo. I was, a big influence on me was Eric Paulson, for sure. I met, Master Paulson in, I guess it would have been 1994. He came to do a seminar here in Montreal. And because he had that Shuto and the catch wrestling, that really sort of matched what my original teacher had taught me. Because of him, sort of, he made me appreciate Sambo a lot more. I started doing some Sambo then. And then I diverted. I had a Southeast Asian diversion where I got into Cali for a few years. That led to some CLAT. Very, very fortunate. We have a very famous instructor in Montreal named Philip Gelina, one of the founding members of the Dog Brothers. He's at an 8-degree black belt under Adrian Imperato and Kaju Kenpo. So we had a common language, heavily under Dan and Asanto and different things as well. And just a great human being, really funny, really practical, could kind of beat the crap out of you with a stick while taking a phone call, effortless. So he was a big influence in the mid 90s. And then it would have been around, I think it was 90, like late 90s that I first encountered Russian Sistema. And I have a dog barking. I apologize. The Sistema was, when I first encountered it, it was so freakishly different that I sought it out only to basically see that it was bunk. I was convinced it was going to be kind of loopy and garbage and freaky. And so it looked laughable, but there was some stuff in it that didn't make sense. And it was close by, we had a very prominent instructor in Toronto, which was about 4.5 hours down the road. So I started training in Sistema, loved a tremendous amount. And, there was something in Sistema. I think that could only be really understood and acquired if you approached it as a system. And so I kind of went deep into that just to experience it. I had had a period in, I guess it would have been 91 to 93, where I had a really bad injury and I needed a foot reconstruction. And at the time, and I know you're an internalist, you know, but at the time, I was all Japanese martial arts, but loved kung fu movies, right? So I was all into the Jet Li movies and whatever else. So I was like, all right, man, I got to do like Qigong and I got to do Tai Chi. So I found we had a very strict German Yang Tai Chi teacher who also did Bagua. And I trained with her for about 2.5 years. Through her, I got to meet a guy, Master Li Man Charn, who was a very prominent Chen Tai Chi master in Montreal and a doctor of herbal medicine. That patterned a lot of my thinking. And I've never been, I don't know, content with form. I get compelled to learn it. I learn it and then I want to freebase it. You know, I want to mix
sure.
it. And a lot of the time, especially in tempo, every different tempo teacher would say, oh no, we do it this way, or we, you know, one little tweak of a thumb, or we open our hand and close it. And it was all these little minutiae, which seemed so pointless. And I just wanted to, you know, and one teacher would say, well, this movement, you're on the left of the person. And the other person would say, no, it's on the right. And it was the complete opposite. And so I love form, but I think I spend most of my day trying to remember what it was to assuage any fear that I have brain damage and I've lost memory. And as soon as I have it, I just want to kind of do my
let go.
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I use a lot of, the original Yang Tai Chi principles. I still do a lot of standing meditation. I still do daily Zazen kneeling meditation. So there's a lot of elements of traditional martial arts that, I would fully concede maybe there's a sentimental love for it. Maybe, there was a reverence for it, you know, when I joined the martial arts. And then there were my greatest early epiphanies associated with it. So it's hard for me to have a negative feeling when I do it. No matter how bad my day is going, if I do some standing meditation, or often I'll start like the long form in Tai Chi, the Yang set, and then just kind of go off into whatever, you know? So how I stand, how I move, how I breathe, how I engage my core, that was all heavily influenced. And I think it informed my jiu-jitsu. Then when I went into Sistema, I don't think there was ever a point in my life I was training less than three styles after my jiu-jitsu sensei left. I was always multitasking and mixing, you know. And in 91, I coined the name Integrated Fighting Systems just because I didn't know what I really wanted to do. And I knew that it had to be integrated. And I was always trying to, and it was Coach Blauer that had an experience. And he's a Montrealer, right? So he was down the street. And early on, I was going to, you know, sort of pick the fruit that fell off his tree and listen at his school. And Richard Dimitri was there, who later founded Bushido. And it was just a hotbed of hedonistic, anti-establishment, self-defense knowledge. So it really.
You guys were the punk rockers.
Yeah.
Breaking away. Yeah.
That's it. And I grew up on all the sort of British punk rock, and that was my thing. So I was like, all right, this makes sense. And I just, I don't know. I just never really had comfort under a label, you know? So like I would do something and I would say like, I'm doing this, but then somebody else would say, well, that's not correct jiu-jitsu because you're integrating this, or that's not correct Sistema because you're doing that. And so sometimes I just, I don't even really think of the label. I just kind of do. I never really tried to preserve a heritage. That's for certain. And I think that evolution is a constant progress process, you know? So when I look sort of at the traditional schools, I assume that they all did what we're doing. They had the same argument.
Yes.
You know, Musashi yes. in 1600. How is it that Miyamoto Musashi in 1600 has to warn you against cosmetic tools and choosing a weapon on the basis of ornamentation and all the dangers and flaws of the charlatan teachers? If you're living in feudal Japan during wartime, they were still there, right? It was still just as rare to be pragmatic. People were forging their scrolls, wandering around, pretending to be, just like we have the fake BJJ black belts now. And in the internal martial arts, it's even harder because how do you, you know, if your eye's not educated, you might get wowed by something that's not wow, right? Certainly in, you know, whenever I tell somebody that I do jiu-jitsu, they go BJJ, and I say, no, Japanese jiu-jitsu. And now 95% of the people you tell that to go, oh, like, I'm so sorry, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Because they think it's just inferior in some way. But I can tell you, like, in 89, I was training with my sensei, and we were doing randori. That was just as hard as our local judo club. The difference is we were allowed to snap the nape and manipulate the face, and he would often throw a training knife on the mat, you know? So, and he had nothing but reverence for judo. You know, he used to tell me, if you have a choice between a karateka and a judoka in a bar fight, have a judo man on your side, you know, because these guys, you know that they've done it. Whereas the karateka, maybe it's the Shotokan guy, maybe it's a Kyokushin guy, you don't know what you're getting, right? And that's not to disparage the style, but he was always like a big believer in training. And I remember he used to have an 8mm film, which recently actually I found on YouTube. This was very cool, but it was World War II Japanese training kendo, preparing for combat. And if you watch this footage, aside from them being Japanese and having modified kendo armor, it's no different from Dog Brother fighting. They're doing, you know, a lot of warding, and it's very, I would say, non-spiritual and highly adrenalized. There's a single hit, they clash, there's a clinch, a throw, a sweep, it's on the ground, and they're bludgeoning each other with the hands, right? And so that's in the 40s. So if you look back at the manuals, the military combatives of the 40s, everything is so 1, 2, 3, very simple movements. And then there's a lot of people today that try to recreate it, and they try to approach it in a sanitized way. But the guys back then, there were guys back then training that simple material as aggressively and as resistantly as anybody training today in a reality-based self-defense. So why would it be any different in 1850 or 1650, right? So I think the resistant, pragmatic, realistic guys have always been in the minority, even in the wars. I've trained with guys who are ex-special forces and have been to war, and they're teaching no touch knock, right? So like, just having been through the crucible of violence doesn't mean that you have the scalpel to cut out bullshit. I think sometimes we have post-traumatic stress. I think sometimes people want to distance themselves from reality. They want to sanitize violence. You know, I remember I read a paper where somebody said that Ushiba, when he made Aikido, it was in many ways an antidote for his PTSD from the Russo-Japanese War. And again, not to disparage, but he had seen so much violence, received, you know, accommodations for bayoneting. I mean, imagine bayoneting multiple people. That's leaving a mark on you psychically, you know, and then you come out of that, and he decides to commit himself to nonviolence and harmony. And whenever I watch, and a lot of my Aikido friends get mad when I say this, but whenever I watch Morihei Ushiba do demos, I always find there's a tremendous hidden violence in him. I find he's very fiery. There's a lot, you know, there's this really great video of him. It's a Japanese documentary, and he's in the garden, and he has this ecstatic smile, and he's doing Joe stuff on the tree. But there's a moment when his like fifth or sixth stab doesn't quite land as squarely as it should, and it glances to the side of the tree. So he basically misses a bit. And the reflex with which he then recoils, swings around and smashes that tree, and the grimace on his face is nothing less than pure primal reactivity, right? So the reason he could make a lot of his stuff work is because he had been there and he had done that. He was an aggressive guy. And if you watch the younger photos of him, and you can see there's a strictness, you know, a brutality. And I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that. I think if you don't really understand violence, you know, I always say pacifism is a choice, but if you don't have the capacity for violence, you can't choose it. You can only be a coward. You can only run away from violence. You have to have the ability to have the choice. So the greatest pacifists in history, to me, had to have had the greatest potential for violence. They had to have had the greatest motivation for it. They had to have visualized it. They had to, in some level, repress it. Otherwise, where's the pacifism? It would just be non-capacity, you know? So I see that in a lot of the traditional martial arts. I see that some of the softer styles being taught are being taught by men that were originally quite hard and aggressive. And a lot of what allows them to make the softer stuff work is that latent, intrinsic, you know, the dam water being held back to create the energy. It's there. You know, Master Yang, the Tai Chi teacher that I trained with here, in his 80s was small and not particularly fit. But if that guy lost his temper, you know, you could feel him vibrating inside. Like, he just had that natural capacity. And my current sensei, Feli Azam, he's a Hanshi in numerous styles of Okinawan karate. He's heavy set. Externally, you'd walk past him and not think much of him. And the first time I met him, he showed up to a Sistema seminar where I was hosting Vladimir Vasiliev. And he was in a polo shirt and like cotton pants. And I was like, oh my God, like this guy's running way too hard for his size. He's going to get hurt, you know? I should warn him. And I remember like, he's too polite to remember it this way, but I remember kind of almost patronizingly like cautioning him, like, you don't need to go that hard, you know? And he was like, no, it's okay. And he just went. And it wasn't until we got into a static push-up hold and these like super bicep driven growth hormone beast men are crumbling after 5 minutes. And then you got this heavy set guy in his late 50s. He's not even sweating and he's like a statue. And he could do it and hold it for 10 minutes. He could do a 1 minute push up, you know, that's when you see where the investment was made in the bank, right? That's when you see somebody and you can't take that. You know, I always say you can't undo an experience. You cut off my arms and my legs, you can't take away my result. I can volunteer to give it up, but if you've made enough of an investment, it's going to be there. So I think whenever I seek out style, I often train in a lot of really traditional stuff. But it's always seeking the teacher first. It's always looking to see what is their approach, what's their energy. I like a teacher that they don't necessarily have to have experienced violence, although most have. But they definitely need to have the ability to push. You know, even Coach Blauer, for example, he'll always famously tell people he's never been in a street fight. Yet he's one of the world's leading experts on, you know, the science of self-defense and modern approaches to self-defense. And it doesn't detract in any way from his insight or his skill or the fact that he's a pioneer, right? Because his motivation is there. His understanding is there. There are people that experience violence and don't have the understanding. They turn around and teach ornate shooting methods and convoluted sword technique and ridiculous knife disarms. And what's dangerous is that people will say, well, that guy was a special forces guy or that guy was a bouncer for 20 years. Therefore, it must be good. Right. Mm-hmm. And the fact is there were samurai that were actively teaching bunk. There's always been good and bad and everything. Right. So
can I interject something, Coach? So absolutely. I had some questions laid out, but yep. Listening to you talk, this popped up some new questions and I want to throw this at you. It sounds like what you're talking about is there needs to be clear understanding of a teaching methodology with a purpose.
Yeah.
And a lot of it also sounds like it doesn't matter what you know. It sounds like you're talking about mindset a lot. Always. And the proper mindset and the ability to, okay, we're sparring in class. It's going to be dialed down for this. But now you're out on the streets. You need to turn that up. Or as one of your videos says, to release the Kraken, if
that's
you will.
That's right. Yeah, I try to base all of my teaching methodology for self-defense on Donald Meichenbaum's stress inoculation research. So he quite famously in the 70s said that in order to be inoculated to stress, there are three natural phases. There's an education phase, which means we need to understand why we're doing what we're doing, right? And if you think to the martial arts, how many times have you seen people training? Why are you doing this? Because Sifu told me to. Right.
That's exactly right.
That's the way it's always been done. Yeah. But, you know, Sensei's 5'2" and I'm 6'7", you know, like it just doesn't match up. Right. So you always have to know what the purpose. Otherwise, there's going to be what in psychology is called an incongruence of skill. You don't believe in it at a fundamental level. There will be enough pressure at some point, whether it's in a knife attack or a beatdown, where that skills confidence lacking is going to cause you to crumble. Right. So why am I doing? I got to know. I got to be clear. Even if I say, I recognize that this is probably sentimental, completely nonsensical, mystical Qigong that I'm doing, but I love it, right? Like I can watch a Jet Li movie and recognize it's not high cinema, doesn't deprive me of feeling this is my favorite movie of all time.
That's exactly right.
So you got to know why. The rehearsal phase is the second step. And Meichenbaum said that the key is that you're always going through a continual grade of resistance. So it should never be the same repetition, always like a snowflake, always different. So if you're doing, your long form, your Tai Chi set, next time do it with weight on the back. Next time try to do it in a restrained space. You do it with your eyes blindfolded. You're always trying to have something different. So stress can be acquired from a push-up. Stress can be acquired from breath deprivation, from sensory effect, from, you know, being spun around, from working in low light. Stress doesn't need to be bodily and injurious, right? Just because I'm 60 doesn't mean I can't pressure. And then the third and final phase is the pressure test. And in Meichenbaum's terms, that's an exposure to stress where you begin to fail almost as much as you succeed. But it's never complete failure, because then that risks going into learned helplessness. And the entire point of the pressure test is for me to go back and to say, you know, maybe that knife defense doesn't work so well for me because I don't have the leg speed. So then how do I modify my education? How do I change my rehearsal? So it should be a tightening spiral. So if I don't have the ability to do my pinan kata anymore because of my knee injury, then I need to learn, is there a workaround? Instead of being a slave to tradition, can I modify it for my capacity? I'm forgetting the guy's name, but there's a very famous kendo competitor who has no legs. And if you watch this guy's footage, he's terrifying. He's basically leaning on one hand, hopping on his hips. And because you're not allowed attacking below the waist, he's swinging. And all of his opponents have they're afraid to extend down and lean in to hit him. And he's just the embodiment of pure warrior spirit, right? It's intensity over method. And so that's a really key thing. So Meichenbaum's language really allowed me to say, this is why this worked. This is why this didn't. You know, I just educate, rehearse, and pressure test in everything I do. And then because I was a school teacher formally trained, and then I worked as a sales trainer, and I did everything from neurolinguistic programming to hypnosis to influence, I'm always trying to pitch the kid. How can I get this information into the student as effectively as possible? You know, and this
two things real quick. Yeah. I'll tell you quick about Bebe Vio. Are you familiar with Bebe Vio?
Nope.
So Bebe Vio is an Italian fencer. She's a multiple gold medalist. She wound up acquiring, was it meningitis? I can't remember what it was, but she lost her arms and her legs. She's a wheelchair fencer for Italy. And she has the heart of a lion. And I'm talking, she is grabbing onto one end, tipping that chair over. And it's weird because some of her slashes are so precise. Some of it looks like classical Olympic fencing. And some of them look like she's going to cut her competitor straight in half with that fencing sword. So I'll have to send you some clips of Bebe Vio. As a matter of fact, she was her and an American archer that has no arms. He uses his, he sits on his butt and he picks up the arrow with his mouth and he pulls with one leg and he holds, and he actually holds records that fully capable archers don't have.
Amazing.
Yeah. So I'll send you their stuff. But two, something that I wanted to ask you about was your teaching background, because something that I find that's unique, I as much as I wanted to interview you today, I feel like this is a sales pitch for your website. The stacking order that you have for your 1 through 6 progression.
Yeah.
Because I know, so what I did when I went to college, I took a doctorate amount of time. I spent 6 years in college for my first degree and 6 minors. And then, in Denver, they were doing a bachelor's degree, a 4-year bachelor's degree in education in 2 years. You had to have a degree in either something like English, Spanish, something that you could take and transpose into education. And so they fast-tracked that program. I never quite finished it, but that first year I fell in love with curriculum planning, curriculum development. My Wing Chun teacher that I've worked with for 25 years is a PhD in educational psychology and cognitive development. So that's a little bit how he shows and presents. It's less Chinese martial arts and more, how is your nervous system reacting to this? How does the body hold weight? And then, you know, things like that. So something that I loved about your methodology is not only is it progressive, but it's very tangible. And something else that I think that's unique is you have categories that someone that doesn't do martial arts can still use. I really feel like your mobility phases are brilliant, as well as your breathing methodology. I know we're on topic, but would you take a minute to talk about how having a background in education has really influenced you? Because I feel like that is the semi-truck hole that most martial arts teachers are missing. I feel like they're trying to teach the martial art and they're forgetting how to teach, which maybe needs to come first. What do you think, Coach?
For me, it was an accident because I was working as a bouncer to pay my way through college, and I was in fine art. And all I wanted to do was draw comics. That was it. But I was in a two-year fine arts program, and every one of my teachers was European, classically trained, and of the opinion that comic book, you know, he'd say there's art and there's comic book shit, but there is no such thing as comic book art. This is what one of my teachers used to tell me. So within 2 years, I was so discouraged that I thought, oh, there's no money. I can't do comedy. It's not real art. I'm not going to grow. I'm going to hate it. They're right. But I knew I wasn't like all the other guys that wanted to go and be a starving artist. Like, they were passionately in love with it. It's like, I don't want to live in a rat-laden warehouse and make paintings and hope for a businessman to buy something so I can eat. So I said, okay, I'm going to go and like, I'm pretty good at talking and I write a lot. So I'm either going to like, you know, go into English teaching or art teaching. So I decided to do fine art teaching. And I live in Quebec, where at the time, 20% of the province was English-speaking. Today, it's less than 8%. And we have some rather draconian rules that limit the use of English. So, for example, you know, it used to be that a sign had to be 50-50 English-French, but French had to come first. Then it was French had to be 70% of the size, and English could come second, but it had to be 30. Then you weren't really allowed having a word like jujitsu or something that wasn't French. You had to translate it. We had a very famous news event called Pastagate, where they tried to sue restaurants for using the word pasta. And now flash forward, we are at a point where it's illegal for me to do business in English. So it has to be French first. Yeah, like I'm supposed to keep my own notes in my one-man company in French. And you go to court, you basically got to get served in French. Like, it's really ludicrous. And although I was born here, I never really, my dad was French. My mom was, you know, English-Irish. And I grew up on a campus where it was all Irish kids. And I was on the side of the English fighting against the French. So I was never really invested. And all the laws were coming in while I was in school. And I had English teachers saying, I got to teach this in French. They couldn't speak French. So I just slipped through the crack. And by the time I got to like college, I was the last year that graduated wherein you weren't legally required to take French in English school. So I just kind of slipped out. And then, of course, I graduated with a fine art teaching degree. And there were probably 12 jobs available in the entire province. So I just couldn't find work. And I was substituting and I was doing occasional days, but couldn't make a living. So I ended up just teaching and bouncing. And that's how I got into it. And at first I had stints as sales trainers because I had an education background. They said, come become a corporate trainer. And in that domain, I got like the full ride. I did every Anthony Robbins seminar paid. I did every Zig Ziglar seminar, neurolinguistic programming, certified in hypnosis. I was doing all of it. I was like the car salesman in the expensive suit every day of my life, you know?
That's awesome.
But I learned communication and I learned plan, you know, really at a high level. And so as a bouncer, I was a smaller guy. I was only about 170 pounds when I was bouncing at the same height. I'm now 250. So I was thin. But I was really good at talking my way out of things and then being really ferocious suddenly if I had to be. And so I think just from an early day, I always planned my lessons. I always had sketchbooks. I always drew and wrote notes. I still have my lesson plans from the early 90s, you know, and so I can look back and say, oh my God, I used to teach this, you know? But I think it's my first teacher used to say, like, you have to respect, even if one person plans their day around coming to your class, you've got to respect that time. You got to make sure you plan, you know? So I plan everything. I plan, like, I'm preparing right now on Thursday. I have a 6-hour seminar at the Montreal Teachers Conference on nonviolent school intervention. And I probably have a 300-page plan that I'll go through for like 20 hours. And then I'll get there and I may not use any of it. But I role play and practice and practice because I have a full house. I'm going to be in a huge, you know, auditorium with 50 really high-level interventionists coming in a moment of crisis, probably. You know, the schools are getting increasingly violent, just like they are everywhere. And there's a lot of anger and resentment that's going to be funneled my way and very desperate questions. And you're there to reaffirm people's faith in teaching, you know. And it's a tough one, but I'm taking it really seriously. My last book last year, State School, was just on that topic, was on nonviolent intervention. And my whole premise was, you know, like a lot of my friends would be like, but you don't have a section on arming teachers or you don't have a section on like the really violent stuff. And I said, all I wanted to do was to teach the teacher that thinks he or she is too old, has no physical capacity, and this isn't my job. They have resentment and they're burnt out. I want to teach them that there's still something within their reach, that they still have the capacity. And my whole belief is that good tactics is good teaching. So the same behavior that makes for good classroom management makes for good conflict de-escalation. Awareness in the classroom is the same thing as tactical awareness. Avoidance in a classroom, avoiding pitfalls and needless, you know, dead ends is the same thing as avoiding a conflict. So I try to teach them skills that enhance their existing teaching capacity through the lens of tactical preparedness. Communication, posture, body language, distance control. Of course, it culminates in physical violence because that's what everybody wants to see. They want the action. But and in my book, what I did was I interviewed about 20 of my good friends that are special forces, Navy SEALs, SWAT officers, elite governmental bodyguards. And I asked every one of them without telling them, I just said, I'm writing a book on school violence. If you had to teach a teacher one thing that you've learned in your 25 years of, you know, being at war, what would it be? Not one of them said a physical technique. Not one of them said viciousness or resolute response. Every single thing was about awareness, you know, decompression, post-traumatic stress management, journaling, breath work, how to use your eyes, how to stand, how to make friends, you know, how to greet your students at the door. It was all basic stuff. And so that's really what I try to impart to like the layperson is that the most elite stuff is the most basic stuff. And sometimes we have to go through all the complexity in the middle because that's what our ego demands. But the real high level guys, if they could impart anything to you with the whole gravitas of their life experience, it would be the simple stuff that's already self-evident to you today. You know, and in Shintoism, there's an expression I use often. They say for something to be sacred, it needs to be simple enough to be done every day, but then it must be done every day. So if you're going to be mindful while washing the dishes, absolutely you can do it, but then do it. Do it every day, right? If you're going to download your Wim Hof app and do 5 minutes of breathing a day, amazing. It's excellent, but then do it. Find no excuse not to do it, right? And we always try to make things too big, like I'm going to lose 80 pounds or I'm going to change my diet or I'm going to lose. And then we make it so big that 4 days in we quit, right? So it's really the small consistencies that make mastery. And that's, to me, that's all I aspire to do, especially as I get older and older and older, is I'm just trying to consolidate and sort of simplify things down to commonality. And that's why I'm re-editing all my old texts and coming out with newer editions and stuff, just to make sure it's still consistent.
Well, Coach, you got to stick around a long time. You know, you've still got a young son, so you got to pick on him
a good long time.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Could you talk about, since you mentioned breathing there at the end and de-escalation and things like that, I think your breathing approach is very special. I read some of the stuff that you wrote with one of our, I can't call her a mutual friend, but I do want to call her a mutual friend just because I respect what she's doing so much. Dr. Belissa, Dr. Belissa Varanche, I read some of your quotes in her book. Yep. And that was even before I found her. I was always following you for a while. And, by the way, I have a funny story for you. I wanted to tell you how I found you. I have a roommate that's like a brother to me. He was the guy that just helped me, out just a few minutes ago. And, at the time I had him training martial arts with me. He was coming to the Shingi and Baguio class, but he was always interested in other martial arts, especially Japanese arts. And, at the time I had a good friend that was in, ninjutsu, and we did some rolling classes together. And so Sam's sitting on the computer one day and he's like, come here, look at this guy. Look at this guy. And I think you were doing a seminar in Australia. And I think this was like 12, almost 15 years ago. You're just kind of rolling on your back and goofing around on your spine. And he's like, what about this guy? And I'm like, oh, he's got it. Like I watched that video and I'm like, you have what I refer to and some people refer to as it. And he's like, well, he's got some more videos. I'm just watching you. And I'm like, that's the first guy that I've seen you Sistema that actually it looks like, I went, yeah, that's doable and that's trainable. And I was watching everyone in the class training it with you. And I'm like, that guy's got it. So my roommate turned me on to you and it was a video on rolling. It wasn't even knife fighting. It wasn't sword work. It wasn't combatant stuff. It was just the rolling. And I think sometimes you have to have a good eye in, martial practice to understand somebody's movement can be excellent, and it has nothing to do with what looks like a physical skill of actually fighting. So I thought I wanted to share that with you. But could you tell us a little bit more about you've had so much background, because I really feel like you're one of the few people that not only understands the Eastern concepts of breathing, but has married it really well with the Western concepts, because I don't think they have to oppose each other. No. I think what you're looking for is maybe that middle ground where they say similar things.
Yeah.
And that's grounds to stand and walk on and move forward on with the work and the training. What would you say on that, Coach?
Well, I had a big foundation in breathing, but it was very simple work in Japanese jiu-jitsu. So we were doing a lot of kneeling meditation. And then when I started doing I did some iron shirt qigong and stuff when I was in Tai Chi, it was very simple, you know, like the San Chin forms in the Japanese martial arts is very similar to reverse qigong. So I had that as a base. So I had a very good, simply taught basis in core engagement, cosmic orbit, basic breath path, and there it was. I entered into Sistema. Sistema has, and I say this as somebody who's on the periphery, you know, not in the legion, but to me it has some of the most innovative mobility work from the Kadashnikov school, and it's, when I look at guys, I know it's sacrilege, but I look at guys like Ido Portal and a lot of these modern body movement guys, they definitely were heavily inspired, whether or not they admit it, from Sistema. And we know because all of these people had epiphanies in the late 90s and early 2000s, but the Sistema footage started leaking in the mid 90s, but the footage is from the 40s.
So right.
They were doing it. It's well documented in Soviet Russia. It's been there for decades. But it only really leaked in like 93 to 96. And then we start seeing it in effect everywhere. And that's fine. And that's great. I think it's the Sistema combination of movement with breath, the different positions that brings it into the domain of like an Alexander method or Feldenkrais approach for body work, which is amazing. But I think the thing that helped me the most, because Sistema was very much a Soviet era art, there is a natural anti-American, anti-Asian sentiment in it. You know, like early demonstrations would be, you attack me with a katana and I'll beat you with my AK-47 bayonet. It was very much like, we're going to get you back for the Russo-Japanese War, right? Like there was a lot of that anger and that resentment. So if you said, you know, what are you training? Oh, I do Tai Chi. Oh, that's why your shoulders are messed up. If you did anything that wasn't Sistema, right, that's why you have arthritis, you know? And some people would like totally believe it. And I would just laugh. Like, I thought this was hilarious. It was kind of like your racist grandfather saying something stupid. You're like, I still love him, but I'm not going to change him. Like, he's just not going to correct. So I would never really argue with them. You know, people would, I remember one of the teachers saying, oh, did you know that your basic Pinan Tapa, the H form, is actually a Japanese symbol to invoke demons? And I'm like, no. Itosso Ank, the guy that created that form, was a PhD in education. And he had to, he believed that motor behavior had to be directed in four directions. And so it up, down, left, right, no invocation of demons, you know, but it served them to have this kind of antagonism. So whenever they would teach it, I never looked at it as gospel. It was never like some mystic formula. I would just say this is kind of cool as a general idea. And, I forget the author, but there's a really good academic article, which is entitled Breathing as a Rational Placebo. And what the article does is they basically show seven main modalities of breath research, and they show scientific evidence that each one works for some people and doesn't work for others. And they say, look, breathing is good, but it's possible that my breath method makes you tense and your breath method makes me dizzy. The important thing is that we breathe. And at the end of the day, there's a placebo element, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, right? As Herbert Benson in the relaxation response says, every time you want to prove a medication works, you test it against the placebo. And if the placebo does better than the medicine, they take that as proof that the medicine doesn't work. But never once do they take it as proof that mind over matter was stronger than the medicine. What if the medicine did work just fine, but breathing worked better in the case, right? And so that's a very interesting sort of perspective. So I went into Sistema kind of, you know, as a heretic on day one, and I just took what I wanted. I probably use 80% of the Sistema method. But you know, a lot of Sistema people, for example, will say, never hyperventilate, never overbreathe. But then somebody like Wim Hof has scientifically shown the values of hyperventilation. And again, if it's a placebo alone, it's worth it. If it works for you, if you like it, if you feel good. You know, when you say something like now in the beginning, Wim Hof was saying it cures depression. And people said, well, you can't measure that. But everyone doing it says, I feel more vitality. I feel better. So what does it matter? If it gives you mindful control over your amygdala and you get a sort of, you know, mindful neocortex override and feel more in command, of course it's going to reduce depression. You're repressing fear. Andrew Huberman now has all this research about primal movement and how forward movement creates lateral eye movement, and lateral eye movement stifles the amygdala. Because our ancestors, when they're moving forward, would have been constantly on the hunt. And there was no room for fear. It was survival. That's a hardwired reflex. And now they've shown that just sitting in a chair and fixating the eyes rapidly left and right represses fear, right? Just like, you know, the spiders in your neighborhood may not be deadly poisonous, but if we keep dropping them in your house, it's probably going to trigger fear for most people, right? Because there's an ancestral trigger. So we can rewire it. We can use it to our advantages, but we got to ignore. So I think with my breathing approach, what I liked about Sistema was that it was really integrating breath and movement. Chinese martial arts, Japanese martial arts, of course, they're doing it, but oftentimes it was very esoteric, you know, like breathe into your arms or breathe into the tip of your sword. Whereas they would say, do 20 pushups without breathing, then come out, now breathe, now inhale, now do 20 pushups holding your breath. What do you feel? It was kind of scientific. You'd explore like all the phases of the breath, and it was quantitative. You could just measure it, and then you had I think it's very important to have measurement and goal setting. And if I, for example, day one, I can do a 1 minute pushup, 30 seconds down, 30 seconds up. But this morning I go to do it and my mind's thinking about something I have to submit or a bill I owe or an argument I'm having. It becomes an instant metric. It's almost like a waking Zen meditation, right? And so I really like that. I really like the idea that you can teach somebody a 1 minute breath technique that immediately gives them results. And that they can immediately measure. And if they can't hold their breath 5 seconds today, they can, you know, work up from four. But that's why Wim Hof is so successful, is that he can take somebody who goes, but I can't hold my breath that long. And in 5 minutes, he has you holding your breath a minute and a half, right? Like that's a very tangible feeling of success. And I think all of the traditional martial arts instructors, you know, every Sifu or Sensei had their way of pitching it, whether it was the August Moon Festival, testicle retraction, stabbing me in the throat with the spear, and all the things they do for money to promote the school. But what better promotion can you have than teaching somebody a 1 minute hack that works immediately? You know, if you could teach an element of Tai Chi or Qing Yi immediately, you know, like from the chair, and how can I stretch? That's going to stay with somebody. That's going to make somebody say, yeah, I want that feeling again. So that's what I try to do in my breath work, is I try to give people instant results, and I try to give them instant metric that they can gauge success, and that they can, because that motivates them to do 5 minutes a day. If every single day they're going to see an improvement, and if they're feeling better, and if they know they have that power. But the most important thing is that I keep it non-classic, and I tell people, make it your own method. If you're doing a shape of breath, make your own shape, your own count, your own rhythm, because ultimately it just matters that you breathe. How you do it is less important. I'm giving you structures that I've learned that work for me. You know, refute it, find yours. If you're asthmatic and have anxiety and the idea of holding your breath gives you an attack, then obviously right. Modify it, right? So that's the key thing. And the movement thing in Sistema is really about reclaiming childhood joy. You know, it's about being on the floor and rolling around, and it just feels so good. It just feels so good. So those have totally changed everything. How I meditate, how I stretch, how I wrestle, my ground game. It's just, yeah. So I just really enjoy the book.
I think people confuse, and I know you've addressed this. It's something that my teacher has talked about. Other teachers have talked about. Owen, my co-host, has talked about when he's teaching me some of the entry drills with the Xing Yi and the Bagua, is I think too many people out there confuse play with fucking around. That's and right. I think play is such a great learning tool for so many things. And when you were talking about that joy of rolling around and that youthfulness of being a kid, I still think that, do you think that that actually has some practicality in something as serious, if you will, as personal protection or self-defense?
Yeah. In my book, Dragon Mind, I say that you have a tiger in the wild. Her cubs could get attacked today. And yet she doesn't line her cubs up in little strict lines and put little uniforms on them, or teach them a three combination Hu Jiao Pao form, right?
I love it. I love it.
Right. So how does the most dangerous predator in the jungle learn? Through play. And there is no more urgency on the planet possible than a young cub in the wild, and they're playing. And how did we learn as ancestral humans? We played. And, you know, and arguably in the Western society, industrialization destroyed that. And my good friend Alex Prophet speaks a lot about this and how it destroyed the body and mechanization, a replacement of, and his style is called Homo Ludens, the playing man. Right? And that's his whole approach, is that play and explore. Because, you know, in science, we call it experimentation. But then, you know, what's different between experimentation and play? That's all it is. Experimentation is play. It is going out to see what is putting things together. You know, in my book, Path of the Ronin, I refer to it as montage thinking, is that it's what we learned in art school, is that genius is nothing more than combining two existing elements that were seemingly unrelated. You know, Einstein puts two things together that didn't seem to match, and then people go, wow, that's genius. But that's all it is. You're thinking in a montage, because everything we have in our life, our most ancient primal experience and our reflex, our childhood memories, and yesterday's bad day, all coexist on the same timeline in our brain. And we can have visceral experiences from an ancient reflex, a childhood trauma, and a bad day yesterday. And they can all coexist at the same time. So why, if we can montage our horrible things together, why can't we put our good experiences together? Why can't we combine our, you know, capoeira with our art school? Musashi said, if you want to learn Kenpo, learn the guitar. You want to learn jujitsu, learn, you know, ikebana, flower arranging. This is the idea, is that you have to, you know, kind of do these classical explorations. The Renaissance man, painting, sculpture, and philosophy. All the great teachers you've ever had, they're either deep into guitar, they're philosophers, or they read, or there's always something extra and deep. It's never just that. Right, they're always finding transcendence. Li Mancharn was an herbalist and a butcher, you know, and he was a butcher, but everything. And I'm a vegan, you know, and I would talk to him, and he would give me enlightenment and all the, you know, the notion of respecting the animal and the sacred space and finding the space between the bones and not, you know, needing to sharpen needlessly. And it was all enlightenment. Everything was enlightenment because he approached life with sacredness. So to me, like, well, you know it, Kung Fu bus driver, right? You know it, right? If you have the right mindset, everything is strength. And I often tell the story that when I was a kid, I was so influenced by all these Shaolin documentaries that I was like 17 on the bus and I was trying not to touch my butt on the seat, but I didn't want people to know I wasn't touching my butt on the seat because then I'd look like a weirdo. So I was trying to find a way to make training happen all the time in my life. And then I realized it didn't need to be this external thing, that you carry it in your mindset. You could be sleeping and going to sleep with the mindset of a war, right? But when we're young, it's very external and it's very manifest.
That's I'll tell you a quick story. I had moved down here with an old girlfriend and ended horribly. I was in a really dark place. And before I found Owen and his group, I kind of used that as a transformative process through working with the group. The only thing that I really had was the bus. And so I use that as my Zen practice because I wound up working 7 days a week and I'm like, well, it may be an illusion, but it's my illusion. The only thing that I can really control is greeting my customers well, focusing on my breath and having a 38,000-pound death machine that's 40 feet long making sure that grandma and the kids in the back get home to their family. So I had to. That was my focus, was maneuvering this large machine well, focusing on my breath and being kind to my customers. And I got to tell you, months of doing that and focusing on that really helped me start to come out of those dark clouds. Yep. So I did. I used the bus, if you will, because it's transportation, if you will. That transportation was my transformation. So
that's Buddhism incarnate, right? It's the Eightfold Path, right? Vocation, right? Thought, right? Speech. It's that's the whole point, is to apply it to everything. I used to struggle when I first learned standing meditation. I was so hypertensive. I'm so jacked all the time. It was painful. And my teacher used to say, well, you have to find out how you can use this in your everyday life. And I remember going, how the fuck am I going to use this in my everyday life? And then not 2 days later, I'm having an anger breakdown in traffic. And then I have this epiphany that the same problems I have in my shoulders in standing meditation, I'm having in my steering wheel management right now. And then I just grabbed that wheel with both hands and straightened my posture. And I started doing standing meditation. And I just breathed right through that traffic and it was fantastic, you know? And so I still do this all the time. I use that. I have my little meditation beads wrapped around my stick shift and I just use that as my, if I'm going to be stuck there an hour each way every day, why not use it for breath practice? And, you know, and this you can do safely. The Wim Hof breathing, not so much.
Yeah. You don't want to. Yeah. I agreed. I know enough about it that you are correct. I've already got enough anxiety that I don't want to add on to it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of picking your passion.
I stupidly thought I was like, I know my body. I'll do a light version. And I tried the Wim Hof method while driving a very even keel. And I just had very gracious people behind me. Nobody honked, but I had this transcendent moment where I was diagonally drifting across four lanes of traffic going, oh, God, like I just zoned out. I was lost in the tingles, you know, and I just managed to surf back before hitting a wall or anything. But so that taught me never to Wim Hof in traffic.
Never Wim Hof. You know, that's maybe a bumper sticker that he doesn't know about that he needs. Yeah, never Wim Hof in traffic. Absolutely. Yeah. Going to write that one down. Coach, what would you say? So I'm listening to what you're talking about. And one of the main topics that I wanted to bring you on for today was talking about how maybe, and it's a twofold, you know, you could have a couple people in different categories for this, but someone like yourself, you know, I think you're kind of unique in the world because you pull a lot of your modern methodology from, if you will, hey, it's October. Why not get a little gross? Yeah. We'll talk zombies and organ harvesting. Yeah. And you harvest a lot of the work that you have from, you know, seemingly dead Asian martial arts and, you know, Russian and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Is there something, cause I know you still love a lot of your Japanese jiu-jitsu and I still know you do a lot of the Kobudo and things like that.
Yeah.
Is there something that someone that's focused primarily on the self-defense teaching, if you will, is there something that they could gain by maybe trying a classical martial arts?
Okay. I think so. Yeah. Like, you know, I recently did an interview where we had in our particular seminar a few Aikido guys and some BJJ guys. And the Aikido guys were all kind of like apologetic. I do Aikido, but, you know, they always had to excuse it. And the BJJ guys were like, ugh, Aikido, like they're mentally handicapped.
Yeah.
You know? And I get it. And I said, look, guys, you're so sure. If you're so sure that you're 100% right, you're so confident in your method, why you got to pick on the little guy? Like, why you got to bug him in the corner? He's just doing his own thing. Is it really that you feel you have a social obligation to police them? Like, you've never, you know, like I used to spear hand a bucket of gravel every day for 5 years and I thought that was going to make a difference. And then I just decided it didn't. I don't judge people that still do it. I loved it when I did it. It just rocked the charm, right? So like, why, how can I decide what your path is, right? And so there are guys out there that do, like, I get it now, like it's, you know, it's the gal has become a living meme and people just have channels dedicated to shredding him. And I think a guy like him is a very good example of how you can go either direction. Because when I was in jiu-jitsu, my teacher was very practical and everybody around me was really esoteric. Very, as he called it, twisty-risty, you know? And my sensei used to always say, well, don't judge him. He's never really been in a fight. And hopefully he never will. He was being very polite. Mm. Like, you know, I don't wish violence on anyone. And I always thought like, wow, man, that's such a generous way to be. And then who am I to say like your approach is not good? Because when I have to teach somebody who's a little bit violent, I teach them restrained technique. And if I teach somebody who's a little bit terrified, I teach them much different technique. So what if your whole style is more appropriate for that person that's more timid or that person who doesn't want it to be as ugly as the evening news and doesn't want the reality based? Who am I to say that you're wasting your time in delusion? Like, where does it start? Like, is European fencing useless? Is it okay? Like, is going to the shooting range when I'm not always going to have a gun in Canada? Is that realistic? Like, where do you draw the line? Right. So if you find joy doing parkour, listen, man, when I do stunt work, the parkour guys can outrun me so goddamn easily. All the martial arts that I have wouldn't have made a goddamn difference. They have a 7-foot vertical jump. And, you know, and they're not that much younger than me. These guys are phenomenal. I hate heights. I don't like climbing. I'll do it if I have to. These guys are fearless, you know?
Yeah.
So like there is value in all of it, right? So I would just say like, if you're doing reality-based self-defense, why not try something that you don't think is going to work? Like, why not try 6 months of capoeira and see if you can't pick up something, loosen a hip, or figure out some way to release your round kick? Or why not do some deep meditation? And what's the danger if you're so confident? You know, and everybody always goes, well, I don't have time to waste. But are you wasting time if you get enlightened? Like, if you stay in one sandbox all the time, you can't be confused when you're always encountering the same cat droppings. You know, like, it's always going to be the same. You got to go out there and get wider exposure. So I'm always like, I look at everything. I look at fencing. I look at wrestling. I look at dance. I look at anything that relates to movement. And I have no issue. And I admit when I change my mind. And I used to teach Kung Fu, and then it stopped working for me. I was bouncing, and I realized I'm only ever using jiu-jitsu. This is not honest of me to teach Kung Fu. And I always refer to it like the Forrest Gump running scene. You know, I just came in and said, I think I'm going to stop teaching Kung Fu now, guys. And everybody was like, what do we do now? And I gave the school over to somebody, and I just stopped, you know? So, like, that's what honest training should be. You know, as Richard Dawkins says, science, it's not that it's provable. It's that it's disprovable. So, like, anybody can prove to themselves what they do is great. But can you prove that it doesn't work? Because when something starts to become dangerous for you, or when a technique is never working for you, that's when it's become disproven. That's when it's time to say, do I really need this? Is this making sense for me? Like, I used to try to acquire the split. I would tie myself. I would sleep. I'd put bags of rice on my knees. And then one day I trained with a Soviet gymnastics coach, and he's like, put your foot up on this block. Turn it sideways. Pull your toes back. Yeah, you can't do split. He did 3 tests, and then 10 things. Yeah, like 50% of the population can. You'll never be able to do splits. Your hips are locked. And I was like, my God, man, I was torturing myself to get within those last 3 centimeters, and I was almost breaking my hips. It was never going to happen. So then I just, as soon as I accepted this is as good as I get, I'll work on different flexibilities. It opened up an entirely different world, you know? But I had teachers trying to make me do something my body wouldn't do. So it's just, it's important.
Going to switch gears here on you, Coach.
Yeah.
And thank you for the little pause break. About a decade ago, I'll tell you a little story, and we're going to talk about middle age and martial arts. about a decade ago, I want to say it was 2013. I had a great friend of mine reach out to me, old powerlifting buddy. And he's like, hey man, you're still having some shoulder troubles. Are you still have really tight shoulders? I'm like, yeah, they're not quite doing what I want them to do. He's like, I found this thing. I know you're into Asian martial arts, but I know you're really practical and pragmatic when you train it. I know you're not into fluff, but I want you to try these anyway. He's like, I bought them for you. Here's a good DVD on them. And, he got me a 1 pound pair of Indian clubs.
Life changing.
And that's exactly what it was. And I watched the movements. I'm like, I love the pattern. And I used to dance in high school. I used to be part of a swing choir. I'm like, cool, let's do this. So, and I think one of the, not problems, I think something that people don't understand with tools like this, they're not overnight fixes. It's going to take some time to open up space in the joints, to work on the fascial layer, because it's not like the muscular layer. You can hit the gym for 3 or 4 months and notice really, really good progress. But with something like an Indian club, it's going to take it time to do its work. And I just enjoyed the process of it. I thought that I'm like, well, this is fun. I'm going to stick with it. And 3-4 months later, it wasn't overnight success, but I did notice, you know, I'm sitting straighter, you know, my shoulders are dropping. They're not hunched up when I drive. And so I'm like, okay, well, let's see where this goes. And I found a gentleman who's also a fan of the Sambo and the Russian system, Scott Sonnen stuff. Of course, I found some of his videos. And so I picked up some of those, a couple of his books, and I wound up picking up the heavy Indian clubs and trying his method out. I really enjoyed it. I'm actually kind of going backwards. I found the esoteric stuff, and now I'm just recently getting into the kettlebell stuff, which is still a little bit on the esoteric flair. And then a couple years into it, I want to say it was 2013, I'm looking for some Indian clubs, and I'm on a website called Onnit, O-N-N-I-T, a little company out of Austin, Texas. And they have this thing as a mace. And I'm like, what is that? And at the time, I think they were selling it for $40 with shipping and handling. I'm like, I'll give that a shot. And you might smile at this. I was raised to be a powerlifter. I've done powerlifting training. And so it wasn't just ego. But it was my misinformed information on long levers and what 10 and 15 pounds becomes.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me about the 50 pound or something.
No, close enough. So yeah. I bought a 15 pound mace.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's 15 pounds.
Yeah.
It's 15 pounds. What do I have to worry about? And the first time I had no, real technique, I bought a video and I watched it. I'm like, I think I know what I'm doing. And the first, I'm in a parking lot and there's blacktop all around. And luckily the whole mace is steel. Yeah. And so I swing it wrong and I'm holding on to it. And that son of a bitch almost flipped my chubby 225 pound ass.
Yeah.
Cause I didn't let go of the momentum and let it carry. And then I worked on it. I choked up on it, worked over it over time. I really feel, I don't know. For me, my joke is these days, I am fighting my profession. My profession is sitting 10 to 12 hours a day under high stress. So the little bit of time I get to train my martial arts, the little bit of time I get to train my strength training, I need it to be dynamic in nature. Yeah. You know, I love Wing Chun. I still teach it, but it's very linear. It's very point A to point B. So doing something like the Bagua or the Xingyi really opened up some different movement modalities on understanding what dynamic movement was, because that's how Owen teaches it. Less is, you know, he does teach it as a Chinese martial art, but it's also dynamic movement. And then going from a bench press, point A to point B, a curl, point A to point B, or just training parts of the body and not training the body as a whole has been a big revelation for me. On top of your breathing and your movement practice, you have some really, really great videos out on the mace and the Indian clubs, integrating it into some of the groundwork that you do with the Systema. Could you tell us a little bit about that and how you're training now that you're 51? Just like my co-host is.
So I was lucky because my first jujitsu instructor always used weighted sticks. Always. They do this in Goju Ryu karate quite a bit. And, we did that. We did a lot of iron sandal training, the geta, which is like a steel flip flop, right? And so the irony is, like, just to give you an example of how what's old is new again. I was in Belgium recently teaching the law enforcement there, giving a summer camp, and my host Nico introduces me to the knees over toe guy. I don't know if you met this guy there.
Right? Yep.
So I'd seen him, but I hadn't paid much attention. So I start seeing this whole notion of declined squat. And I go, oh my God, like this is totally what we would do on the geta, because the geta has like two platforms underneath. And if you would lean all the way forward onto your toes, it would flip onto sort of the front end and you'd be at a 45 degree steep downward skiing position and try to do squats. And then this guy's always saying like the most important thing is the tibialis and you have to do retracted toe movement. And sure enough, when you had the geta on, one of the basic exercises was a slow thrust kick, which is just burning the shin, right? You're pulling your toes back with 10 pounds of weight. When I got into Systema, I trained with a guy named Andre Sosnovsky, who was a very famous sambo master, and he's jitting his toes into a kettlebell, picking it up off the floor with his toes all the way back and doing thrust kicks with it. Same exercise.
Wow.
And now we see all these declined wedges and, you know, inclined squats and everything else. And it's the exact same thing. So there's only so, like, people knew it was working. They didn't know why. And then when I spent some time in India and I got really interested in Gushti and Indian wrestling, and they were all about the gata, about the mace club. These were the originators of it. Persian wrestling has it as well. So I had a desire, but my first one, I actually have it right here, is a 20-pound short-handled mace that I got.
A little bulova almost.
Yeah, it's amazing, this one. And it's quite different. That's much closer to the Goju Ryu one. And then I have some 10-pounders. I have them here, but like a 10-pound club, it's a lot when you get going, you know? And
absolutely.
So I use those the most. But I have the ones in the twos as well. The big distinction of my approach is that I have nothing against the classical body exploration, but my whole thing is I'm there to train combatants and I want health to be consistent. So I'm always trying to train correct combative grip. And for us, it's very important that we don't do a lot of spinning. We don't pinky up and release the pommel of a weapon.
Sure.
So whereas in a lot of Indian club work, they grab the ball or they're very loose in the grip and they're kind of flipping it. I'm always maintaining my bottom two fingers tightly on the grip. So it reduces your range of motion. It demands more of your wrist and your forearm, gives you a much stronger grip, but it immediately ensures I'm not developing bad habits for stick or sword or gun or knife or whatever. That's important. But then on the ground, there's not a lot of Indian club or mace work on the ground. In Sistema, they do a lot of work with just a stick, and you know, where somebody will like kind of hit you with a stick and you kind of move and evade, and they use the arm as a frame to guide it, or they just narrowly escape it and trace around with the arm like a snake. So I use that principle a lot with all of my ground mechanics, and do all of my ground mobility. I have a low ceiling in the basement as well, so I can do all that stuff on my knees, and fantastic. Like, if somebody has never tried clubs or maces, it doesn't matter if you, you know, there's a great Instagram channel called Persian Yoga, which is amazing push-up benches and all sorts of mace work. There's tons of official Indian club sites that you can find. Yeah. Find anything. There's so much free material. Find anything. Look up any of my trailers. I have tons of free exercises. Just all I would say, and it's basically what you caveated, buy the lightest pair possible. Buy 1 or 2 pounds.
My goodness, yes.
10 pound on a mace. Because you'd rather have something that you can use effortlessly and fearlessly. And if it, look, everybody can learn to swing a 30 or 40 pound mace in a tight, contracted way. But if you take a 10 or a 15 pound and get masterful at it, you're going to open your body. You're going to extend your joint capsules. You're going to rejuvenate that synovial fluid. You're going to strengthen the elasticity. And it has been transformative. There is a lot I like in the martial arts that also destroyed me. You know, and a lot of like repetition, yeah, sword and thick work, there was no recuperation like this. How did we strengthen sword work? We did sword work. You know, that's not, we just did the same movements over and over and over. So, you know, it's just, I can't say enough goodness about it. It's fantastic. It's been around for thousands of years. And it just feels great. It feels great. You can do it to some extent with like a set of Pilates balls or something light or with elastic, but they're so cheap now and they're so easy to find. You can get them on Amazon, delivered anywhere. Just get yourself a pair of, you know, maximum 2 pounds each, max, and just play, get some YouTube videos, start swinging. It is life changing. Yeah, really, really life changing. Everybody I've introduced them to in person has changed their bodies, eliminated injuries. And like you said, you know, it is fascia, it is deeper things. So you're going to like it and you're going to see, yeah, it feels good. But then after 2 to 3 months, then you go, oh, that doesn't do that anymore. That's not popping. That's not cracking. That pain's gone. I had a shoulder injury for 18 months. I was told, like, don't do a pull-up. Don't do that. And I listened and I was doing physio and it was just getting worse. It was cracking every time I did a push-up. And then I said, and the guy said, stop the Indian clubs and the maces. It's just not. And I said, okay, that's what you. And then I just said, forget all this noise. I went back to the Indian clubs and the maces, like with full intent. 3 months later, it was perfect, and I have no issues. It's been 10 years. So now I'm back. I can do pull-ups. I can do everything. So, yeah, you got to listen to your body. You know, sometimes we're injured and we just need a bit of time, but not moving, unless it's, like, broken and healing, it's very rarely the solution. Like, movement is life. So we have to find a way to stay mobile, however it is.
Got 2 questions for you, and then I'm going to let you enjoy your day. And again, thank you so much for your time. This has been far more than I was expecting it. And this has been so much fun for me. I've always wanted to do this for a while. This has been years in the making, and finally here it is. And I hope maybe down the road, maybe a year or so, we can have another conversation. Love to chat with you again. Tell us about what's good. Cause you just re-released Dragon Mind. Could you tell us about some of the books that you've published? And you mentioned last year, the school safety book that you published. Would you tell us about some of your authorship? Did you say you had another book, something, Path of the Ronin?
Yeah. So my first one was the Dragon Mind, which was more philosophical and psychological attributes of warriorhood. Really, you know, it sort of addresses what's your view on violence? Do you think people are intrinsically violent? Are we fatalistic? What are your governing ideologies as a martial artist or self-defense practitioner? And it basically goes through how that can affect us, gives some anthropological evidence. There's a lot of pragmatic drills, psychology, addresses fear of death, addresses a lot of sort of what I think are central to warriorhood. And I wrote that back in 99. So it was almost 25 years ago and it needed a redo. So I just recently republished that on Amazon. This year, I also re-released my Paladin Press book from Combat Sistema. The handbook, because that had been out of print since Paladin went out of press or out of business. And, the book was like, I don't know, it was selling on Amazon for like $500 a volume and stuff. And it said, no, it was just in demand still and people were gouging. So I republished it at normal prices and that's available. And then this year, my main release, my new book was Safe School, which is a nonviolent intervention book for anybody really working with the public schools, interventionist. I was an intervention instructor for youth and correctional. So it's really just a host of nonviolent strategies that can be integrated by professionals, regardless of their background. And then in 2005, I had another book I wrote, which was called Path of the Ronin. And that has been available as a download with some of my videos, but I'm making a formal book version of it. And that's really purely psychological drills, mostly self-hypnosis and visualization. And what motivated that was I encountered this young girl who had been violently attacked and abused. And she was barely able to handle proximity. Like she had trouble taking the bus, trouble functioning in society. There could be no physical contact. She was very badly damaged. And she was visiting the pain clinic. We had a pain management clinic in our building and got off at my floor by error. And then ended up being intrigued by the dojo and the weapons and came back sheepishly to ask them questions. And so it begat the question, how good am I and what use is this if I can't help somebody like her? Like if all I can do is teach physical tricks, you know, like what am I going to do when I'm 80, right? So I started really looking at some of my sales training and some of my hypnosis work and saying, how can this be modified? How can we improve basic assertiveness? How can we strengthen mindfulness? How can we do this for somebody with, I mean, starting below the zero block, but just absolutely deficit? And so really it is just a collection of progressive psychological and visualization exercises, partly to give us permission, partly to get us thinking in different ways, take all the mysticism out and to just be very practical and to give you sort of the ability to feel results as you do it and to make choices. Say, this one I like, this one doesn't work, and to really get into it. So that's really the premise of that one. That one's just being edited now. So hopefully within a month, that'll be out. Then I can rest because then all my books will be newly editioned and out. But that's the goal.
Any other books in the future, Coach? Would you ever think about doing something about teaching?
Yeah, I've been keeping a lot of notes now because I'm working mostly with teachers. So I am thinking about doing something more in that domain than just kind of like a teacher's journal and insights and sort of reflections on that. Because there's a lot of different experiences I've had teaching around the world, you know, from military to civilians to juvenile delinquents, you know, and sometimes it's not the mainstay topic that you would have in like a martial arts class, but it's deeply relevant, I think.
Sure.
And I mean, now that the school book is out, I'm getting a lot of feedback from people who are saying, you know, what do I do with this? Or how do I get people to listen? Or the kids are, you know, being disrespectful in this way. So just basic classroom management, conversation management, these things are, I think, overlooked.
Yeah. Awesome. I guess the last one would be, and I'm going to caveat this with, one of my favorite teachers besides yourself that does martial arts, but really, how do I say, pragmatic. He does more traditional martial arts, but he's like, I keep tradition, but my new thing that I do is I update how it's taught and educated. So I'm taking classical martial arts and giving it, you know, the modern press and shine of how do I teach this? This is my friend, Sifu Ruth Smith. We just did an interview with him. And his last quotes on our podcast that I did with Owen Schilling, my co-host on Kung Fu Conversations, was I asked him as he was leaving, and then I'll take it back to the main question that I had for you, is I asked him, I'm like, well, what do you have, you know, a finishing comment with your audience today? Because most of our listeners are classical martial artists. And we do have folks in Aikido listen to us. We have Karateka that listen to us. And his take was very brilliant. And I'd like you to talk not so much about his take, but I thought that I'd share this with you today. It was like, have an understanding of what your relationship is with tradition. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to come up with your own personal relationship with tradition. Are you holding on to a pomp and circumstance thing that happened 350 years ago?
That's right.
And on a kingdom and a language that you don't understand, we don't live in that time. Are you holding on to something, not even movement based, but it's like, mm-hmm. You can't cross train with this person. You can't look at that person, what they're doing. So I thought that was very pragmatic for someone that teaches traditional martial arts. Coming back to my original question and why I wanted you on the show, as you're leaving, could you give us, what do you think a bridge is between classical martial arts training and the modern person and maybe modern combatives. Is there a bridge, or is it just non-existent? Is that valley uncrossable? What do you think, Coach?
I definitely think there's a bridge. Because if you look at, let's take the example of BJJ, which is one of the largest influencing factors in MMA. You know, in its early days, it was known as Brazilian Judo, then became
Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Yes.
You see them now retrofitting it with Japanese language, you know, teaching leg triangles, the Sangaku, and looking back at terms. In the early days, publicly, they weren't, many schools of BJJ weren't promoting leg lock. They were saying it's, you know, they're not that good, or they're dangerous, or we shouldn't use them. And now it's the mainstay. It's completely changed. Guys like Gord Ryan have completely changed that game. So I think, you know, because they are pressure testing so hard, they are evolving faster, but it's kind of like testing medications on fruit flies because they have a 24-hour lifespan. We can see the effect much more quickly. So in BJJ, we can see this massive evolution, right? We can see what they're doing. And if it's already been created, go back, look at it. How was it done? Then improve that. They're not trying to recreate leg locks. They're looking back at the traditional work and saying, how can we improve it? So I think that's extremely important, is that if we want to keep tradition relevant, not just alive, but relevant, we have to ask ourselves, what bearing does this have? Why was it done? And I've always used as my guideline that tradition and respect for tradition should come from a place of gratitude. So for example, in our style, when we meditate, we always bow twice. And we always say we bow first to all of the ancestors that died to provide this knowledge, that brought it to us. And then we bow. We don't line up. We circle. We bow out of equality to one another, out of respect for the sharing of sweat and blood we're about to give. So it's always those two tiers of gratitude. All of the people that came before us and all of the people that made the effort to be there with you that day. So anything that builds gratitude is good tradition. To me, training is about freeing me from limitation, whether it's bondage, you know, shackles of stress, whatever it is. If your tradition is shackling you, limiting you, restraining you, then I would argue it's not good tradition. To me, it should be growing my gratitude and building connections and not separating me from other people. So in appreciating traditional jiu-jitsu, I should be more understanding of the BJJ guy who's insulting traditional jiu-jitsu for not understanding, and more tolerant when they come to you to say, well, how do you do this work? And you know, now they're using traditional breath work or traditional meditation work. This is what's missing in MMA. This is what's missing in the modern arts, is that they don't have that tradition. And then you go to the veterans that are now, you see the 50 and 60-year-old MMA fighters. What are they doing in their old age? They're COVID. Look, a guy like Boss Rutten, breath work, meditation, mindfulness. You don't think Musashi was a badass in his youth and would have been a really rough teacher and then became more esoteric? Takawan Soho was a warrior first, a monk second. It's a natural progression. So we are living in a time of incredible martial volatility. There are a lot of things being called into question, but I think that pendulum will swing back to a period of more mindfulness and appreciation. We're seeing it with mobility work. We're seeing it with breath work. But I think basic meditation and the need for tradition, when you see a BJJ instructor accidentally breaking somebody's neck in class, when you see these kinds of things, you recognize that some of the safety limitations, some of the more sterile, less competitive arts, at some point they were doing it for a reason too. You know, if you teach in a public school where they don't want contact sparring, etc., you start to impose the same limitations that tradition used to impose. So there's a reason. There's a reason for everything to have occurred before. And I think anytime we arrogantly go in and just mock it, we're sort of depriving ourselves of a learning opportunity and a capacity to connect with what's come before. So yeah, that's my take on it.
Fantastic. Coach, again, thank you so much. I'll let you know when this episode drops, but we'll also include your website, probably your Instagram and your YouTube page. And then I've got a copy of your book. It's in my car right now because it goes to work with me. It's my reading material. So I can't show it right now, but I've got Dragon Mind and I'm enjoying that thoroughly. So thank you for your time. And I hope to do this again in the future, my friend.
Sounds good, brother. Thank you.
Have a blessed day, Coach.
Awesome.